I'm Paul Tolchinsky. I've been an org designer for 40 years. I'm the co-founder of the European organization Design Forum, and I've been a part of this community since I moved back to the US 6, 7 years ago. Today's session came about as a result of, I was having individual conversations with Chuck Snow and with Finish about the work that they were doing. And what I realized is that they're on parallel paths, talking about the paradigm shift in how we think about and do org design. Chuck, with the new book coming out, Chuck, Amazon says I'm going to get mine on November 24th.
So we'll see.
It says November 24th, the delivery day. And Finish has been working on an AI tool that is unique and specific to org design. And so we had two thought leaders who are both working in this space that is one of the hottest topics on the planet right now. And so I thought, wouldn't it be fun if we got them together and had a conversation about what does it look like? What could it look like? And actually give you an opportunity to play with an example that Finish and Nia have been creating together. Chuck's book, if you haven't already read the pre-work, designing adaptive organizations. Our process is going to be, what we've agreed is Chuck is going to give you a little bit of background around what's coming in the book, what the thinking is, and what his current thinking is. We'll do a Q&A with him. Then we'll switch to Finish. He will talk about the tool that they've been working on in creating, which is based off of the Microstructures and Organizations book. He and I just came from a EODF session because their conference is starting tomorrow. So there was a pre-conference. And then we'll do a Q&A with him. You're going to actually get an opportunity to play with the tool a little bit. And then we'll finish with an open conversation. So the plan is 90 minutes. You will get an email at the end of this, those that are here, to be able to actually access the tool and to experiment with it on your own. Actually play with it real on your own time. So I don't think Chuck and Finish need a lot of introduction to this community, right? Two of the best thought leaders in our field right now. And Chuck, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. As Paul indicated, I'm going to give an overview of our book, Designing Adaptive Organizations, which will be published, I guess, November 24th, now I hear. They don't let us know. They just say November. I think there's a lot of good stuff in this book about modern organizing, and I'm really excited to present kind of an overview of it for you today. This is my first time presenting the book, so I'm curious about your feedback and see if it intrigues you to move to the purchase decision. I guess Paul already has, but that's good news. Okay, the book is going to be published by Cambridge University Press, and Cambridge has always had a long-standing interest in the future of work. How it's going to be organized and how it's managed. I was invited to write a book on organization design, or I guess I should say edit a book on organization design for Cambridge's Companions to Management series. And this is a series of, I guess you'd call them supplemental books that could serve as a supplemental readings book for a course in, say, organization theory or organization design or the future of work, something along those lines. But it's also intended to be a standalone book that can also serve a practitioner audience. It's supposed to be written in understandable language and not dry academic language. It's supposed to have a practical orientation, that is translating any ideas that might be in a book in this series so that students and managers can understand it and apply it. So I quickly brought in my colleague as a co-editor, Øystein Fjeldstad, who's at the Norwegian Business School, And I've been working with him for about the last 15 years. So virtually any project, I work on it with him, not by myself. So Tanya, are you able to show the table of contents? Well, there's the cover. All right, I don't want to go over each and every chapter. I'd like you to just take a glance at it, and I'll mention a few things about some of the chapters to give you a feel for what the territory is that this book covers. This is not a complete compendium on the history of organizational forms, what we would call traditional forms these days, the functional organization or the divisional organization, the matrix organization. This is devoted to relevant topics around modern organizing. And everybody knows, or everybody seems to want to have organizations that are more adaptive, more resilient, more flexible, quicker to respond to today's changing environment. So Uystein and I brainstormed this table of contents, and then we invited experts in each of the topic areas to write their chapters. And I see if you take a look at the book, you'll see that these are all well-known people in the field of organizations. Chapter one, design thinking and organization design. Design thinking is the latest set of ideas and tools concerning organization design. As I've been tracking this particular topic, it seems to be having some difficulty in getting into mainstream practice. So this is something to keep your eye on. I think it's relevant and useful, but it seems to be, at least in the articles that I read, it seems to be struggling to get traction in a way that consultants, designers, and managers are actually using it. So maybe this chapter will nudge things along a bit. I certainly hope so. The open organization is basically saying that the typical organization needs to, quote, open up. It needs to be able to search both internally and externally for resources wherever they may exist, and to try to identify resources that are useful to them, and then connect with those resources and form some sort of linkage that can jointly accomplish something. So the open organization is an interesting chapter in that it indicates how organizations can open up. Chapter three is Uystein and my chapter on actor-oriented organizing. This is an alternative to hierarchical organizing that enables actors to self-organize, to self-coordinate, self-control. And in this sense, when actors connect with each appropriate actors, connect with each other and start interacting, then structure really flows from those interactions. So structuring or organizing is a continuous process, and it results from the interactions of key actors. This is what we called in the preface the paradigm shift, because we're going from the traditional paradigm of organization design, which is specifying the structures and their complementary processes to managers and decision makers, and talking about the pros and cons of the known organizational forms, and helping them choose one, and then slotting people into the appropriate boxes, and filling out the division of labor, etc. Actor-oriented organizing is, in a sense, just the opposite. The shift in the paradigm is to enable actors to identify appropriate relationships, make connections, and then operate those relationships without a lot of hierarchy getting in the way. Chapter four is Phoenicia's chapter, collaborative conflict management. Today, the term bossless organization is being tossed around. You know, this chapter is more than that, but it's a very nice theoretical description of how an organization can resolve its conflicts without resorting to authority. So this is one of the many takes on anti-hierarchy going around these days. And this chapter is, how can people collaborate with the inevitable conflicts that occur? How can they be resolved without kicking them upstairs to higher level authorities? The platform organization, those authors talk about two types of platforms, transaction platforms and innovation platforms. These platform organizations are actually what the biggest companies in the world are organized as. And you'll see in that chapter that the authors talk about the fearsome five, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, et cetera. And these organizations are so dominant and so pervasive that they are causing a backlash in terms of regulatory authorities and so on about how do we get these companies under control and how can they serve society rather than have the downsides that we're currently seeing. Chapter 7, Organizing Intelligent Digital Actors. This is a chapter on, let's say, a practical version of AI. How can it be incorporated into organizations, especially in the digital world that we now live in? And so that chapter talks about how human actors and digital actors can collaborate as partners. Let me skip to the global organization. This chapter deals with those organizations that have the most hierarchy. And this book is not intended to say hierarchy is going to go away with these new forms of and processes of organizing. It's not to say that at all. Hierarchy is always going to have a place in organizations. It just needs to be in the proper place. And global organizations, because of their scope and scale, are the ones most in need of hierarchy, but it needs to be sort of modern hierarchy, hierarchy that helps the organization rather than slows it down or makes it difficult to operate. So this is a very nice chapter that makes a distinction between the vertical organization, how to design the hierarchy, and the horizontal organization, how to allow the organization members, the actors, to collaborate and do their work. Okay, well, let me go back to this notion of a paradigm shift. And because I think this is probably the most relevant point to make relative to you as practitioners, if this is indeed going on, I think it is, then we're going to be in a bit different world, and one that you are going to, if you help your clients, are going to have to operate a bit differently. There's Thomas Kuhn's paradigm shift. He's the author who coined this concept. And what Kuhn said is that in a scientific discipline such as organization design, and I guess we won't today spend time debating whether this is a scientific discipline or not, but in a scientific discipline, when there's a fundamental shift in the basic concepts and practices of a scientific discipline, then something could be called a paradigm shift. It's sort of your way of looking at things, your attitude about that phenomenon, how you go about analyzing and interpreting it and so on. The concepts and practices of that discipline are shifting. And in our case, Paul's title for today's session was The Coming Paradigm Shift. I think it's already here. It's been here for a while. A paradigm shift isn't an off-on kind of situation. It's a gradual evolution, but I think we're well into it. If you could show the next slide, Tanya, here's my take on how to capture that that shift. In a very simple sense, it's going from the notion of a noun to a verb. from studying organizations as static systems that have a structure and a set of processes associated with that structure, and then looking at it in some sort of snapshot sense of here's how things are organized. That focus is now shifting to the verb organizing. What is the process of organizing, and how does that result in structures rather than vice versa? So I think today's organization designer and consultant really needs to help organizations develop the means that enable goal-directed self-organizing, where the actors themselves control and coordinate their performance. The next slide shows some key concepts, next two slides actually. What I wanted to do here, and I'll let you know how I actually did it, which was to flip to the index in the book and look at all of our concepts that these authors had submitted in their chapters. And I tried to pick the top 20. I don't think there's actually 20 here. And I culled the list down to those kinds of concepts that are most associated with the paradigm shift, with this notion of developing the means for actors to self-organize. And if you take a look at those, maybe you could also show slide 2. I see 3, 7 there, and 7 more. So 14 key concepts. Now, I, as a researcher in this field, you know, I'm always reading the journals and reading the articles, and I would hope that over the, let's say, the next 5 years, that we'll see more discussion of these kinds of things than we've seen in the past 50 years. Traditional organization design has a body of literature that is useful, but primarily for the organizations of yesterday. And as we get a better grip on what's going on right now and come up with solutions for today's organizations dealing with complex, dynamic environments, these are the kind of concepts that are going to make some headway. And they're not new in the sense that they've been in the literature, but they're going to require increasing emphasis as we move forward. Paul.
Chuck, there's a quick question about what is Stigmergy?
Quick question about that? Okay. Stigmergy, it was actually a concept coined by a French, I believe, biologist in France, and as applied to organizations, it is the process of coordinating actors coordinating with one another using a representation of the task environment as its vehicle. Now, that was kind of a mouthful of a definition, but if you think of one of the examples in the chapter is of a company called Autodesk, which is an engineering company that builds large buildings and large processes. I mean, large projects. So in a digital world, it's much easier these days to have a representation of the task environment, because you can, in Autodesk's case, show the skeletons of a building and then have the various engineers and builders that are going to construct that building weigh in on a regular basis, make changes in that design on their computers with that representation, and see what the impact it has. The others who are observing those changes also have immediate feedback about the impact that would have on their piece of the design. So it's the ability of the actors to coordinate among themselves without any intervention in hierarchy or anything else by using that representation of the task environment. In that case, they're called digital twins. They make a twin of that building and allow all of the designers to make their changes and do their experiments in real time. Ustein and I debated about whether we should translate that into some more manageable concept than Stigmergy, but decided that Mr. Grasset in 1959 gets credit for it. We're going to keep using it. Okay, I think that's probably my last slide. And that's just in there in case we need it.
Well, there are a bunch of questions, Chuck, in the chat box, right? So maybe we could go to some of the questions that are there.
Okay.
You know, and I think, you know, that, I mean, if we stick with the Stigmergy question for a moment, the last question that Shubha just posted is there a difference between Stigmergy and digital twin, as you understand it?
I'm probably going to say a digital twin is a representation of, is an example of Stigmergy. There could be other forms, but it's essentially a representation of the task environment. When I first came across the notion of shared situation awareness and its importance in designing organization and in running organizations, the example that was given to me of a representation of the task environment was police officers coming to the first shift and hearing the sergeant describe what's going on in their neighborhood or district these days and what they're looking for, what kind of activity is worth looking into and so forth. And so you can imagine, I don't know, 30 or 50 police officers sitting in a room and the sergeant standing up there and saying, okay, this is going on, that's going on. I'd like people to keep an eye out for something of this sort and so on. That is a very crude representation of the police officer's task environment. In a digital world, we can have very sophisticated representations of the task environment, such as that Autodesk example I was telling you about.
Shubha, does that answer your question?
I guess I was trying to understand because there was another topic as representation and there was something that said digital twins. I was trying to understand what does that cover and what is Stigmergy. So I was trying to understand the difference between the two.
Yeah, digital twins are a representation of the task environment. The twin is the digital version of the reality.
Thanks a lot. Yep. I guess I have to read the book.
Ah, okay.
well, there is a question. Maybe I'll jump on that real quick. There's a question in the chat box about the book. You know, it as you describe it, Chuck, it sounds more theoretical than practical. How would you describe it?
Both. I mean, we were given our marching orders in the very beginning. It's conceived as a companion to management in terms of teaching a course. If a professor was using a textbook, this could be a companion to that textbook on the specialized topic of organization design. But they want the audience to be academics, not as a reference book, everything you know about Stigmergy, but rather, in addition, something that students and managers and designers could use and understand. You know, organization design is a prescriptive body of knowledge. It's taking what we know about organizations and helping, in consultants' case, clients understand what they might accomplish if they redesign their organization. So, this book has to include those people as the audience, and we were told very clearly and sent examples of books about writing style and use of examples and so on, so that this would be an eminently readable book. And we believe it is. I don't think you'll have any trouble reading any of the chapters and understanding what's being said.
Super. Thank you. There's a couple questions about your comments about goal-directed. You know, one is, what shifts do you see and who sets the goals? And how do these keep these goals adaptive? And the other question is about, if goals are adaptive and emergent, then how do you do design in an actor-driven world?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Well, an organization is a goal-directed activity system. That's what an organization is. So every organization is set up to accomplish something that an individual could not accomplish on his or her own. So we need to have a sort of a collective mindset in play at all times. How do you get this system moving in the direction to accomplish the objectives that you want to accomplish? Now, when goals are just simply handed down by the hierarchy, and you know, that's the world that I grew up in. You know, managers figured out what needs to happen in order for the firm to be profitable, let's say, and then they let the employees know, this is what you need to do for us to meet our goals. Management by objectives was invented as a concept back in the 50s or 60s to try to get employees kind of participating in the process. You know, rather than just being the recipient of goals, at least have a say in what the goals are. And now I think we've moved all the way down to towards the other end of the continuum by saying actors could set their own goals in conjunction with other actors with whom they are interdependent, as long as they realize what the mission of the organization is and what overall strategic objectives it wants to accomplish. To run it through the hierarchy involves a lot of delay and distortion and so on. So, but goals have to be in alignment or you won't get the system moving in the same direction. So that means that from a designer's perspective, we have to have develop the means that allow actors to interact, including goal alignment.
And I mean, you know, the question about if the future is emergent and we don't know it, then how do we organize for it?
Okay, another good question. I don't have a slide, but if you can imagine the continuum of, let's call it, environmental conditions or the environment that organizations face. At one end of the continuum is a stable, predictable environment. And that's what all the traditional designs are essentially based on. If the environment doesn't change that much, then you can have a lot of standardization, rules, routines, ways of doing things. You can have the bosses figure out what those routines ought to be, and then they train their employees to carry out the routines. But at the other end of the continuum, and more like the world most of us live in today, the environment is complex, dynamic, and in a digital age, increasingly interconnected. And the old forms of organization really aren't up to the task of keeping pace with these kinds of environments. But in between, every organization exists in there somewhere. And in whatever assessment process you would use to decide where the organization is in terms of its evolution and its navigation of its own perceived environment, you need to know where they are on that continuum. You can even go a deeper dive into the organization and say some businesses or some units are really pretty stable. And what we need to do is make them even more efficient than they currently are. But those that need to innovate or search and prospect, they need to be organized in a different fashion. So I would say that Well, somebody probably needs to write the book that collects all the organizational forms that we know about and put them on that continuum. But that's the full comprehensive framework that you need.
Well, you've triggered a whole bunch of conversations in the chat box, right, about emergence and adaptive and complex systems, and are we talking about purpose-driven or goal-driven? If it's about emergence, then how does design theory work in all of that? You've triggered a whole bunch of sidebar comments about all that. I think the question that's in here says, or maybe it's, what's the relationship with the environment in an adaptive organization design approach?
Every organization has to be able to adapt to its environment. so that's a universal concept. If I use my own terminology of defenders and prospectors, defenders live in an environment that's pretty stable and predictable. And as I just mentioned a minute ago, pieces of organizations are sort of defenders. They need to do the same thing over and over and over again in the most efficient manner. I also believe that even in industries that are considered fast moving and highly innovative, there are pockets of where a firm can exist to defend that business. And their environment is stable, more or less, stable and predictable, and they need to be efficiently able to deal with that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So it's searching both within and across organizations and industries what the particular focal firm's position is and go from there.
Yeah, awesome. The other question, and then maybe we'll switch over and give Venetia an opportunity to talk about what it actually could look like to do design in an emergent worldview. But the other question, the other one that's in there in the moment was, in the model that you're imagining and the future you're creating, right? How does alignment and cohesion occur, right? If not through hierarchy.
Well,
I mean, is it a well, go. I mean, I think that, I'm actually, Jim, you asked the question. Maybe you could elaborate on it a moment. Jim, where are you, Jim? Dolly?
The assumption in steep and deep military organization structure, hierarchical organization structure, is that the senior leaders cascade downwards through leadership, those things that keep everybody bound together and make alignment happen to make things happen. In the holocratic organization, sort of the closest to adaptive organization model at this point, is that everybody chooses what to do and they're bound by something. For example, we're all here to change the way people think about nutrition. So everybody then asks the question, is what I'm about to do consistent with helping to change the way people think about nutrition? And they bind on values. We believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Am I taking this action in a way that demonstrates living diversity, equity, and inclusion? Where does the cohesion come from in this, from the book's perspective? Where does the organizational cohesion come from?
I'm going to give you an answer that was triggered by what you said about command and control organizations. Are you familiar with network-centric warfare?
Yes.
The NATO document, the sort of operative NATO document. That document was largely written by a person named David Alberts, who's the president of the International Command and Control Institute. And that document, or that type of organizational activity, let's say, is very much actor-oriented. And David Alberts was kind enough to give us a sort of a testimony. It'll appear on the back cover of the book, where he endorses this actor-oriented framework of ours. The military, traditional military model of command and control best fits into those environments that are stable and predictable. It's not going to work very well. Look at the Russians in the Ukraine. How are they doing with their bosses and soldiers? So
I wouldn't confuse ineptitude with command and control.
Good point.
So I think the example, you know, I've worked with a good deal of military officers, and the examples they give is that if you take a group of soldiers from the U.S. Army and you give them a mission, and conditions change to any significant degree, they have to come back and check the mission. If you do the same thing with the same number of Marines or Navy SEALs, they will carry out the mission by adapting to the conditions from a playbook of various scenarios. So the sort of the cohesion in that structure comes from, you know, they are very different. They operate differently. What we've run into in designing adaptive organizations is that essentially the hierarchy gets replaced by shared information.
Right.
That everybody knows what decision principles to apply. Everybody knows what customer value is. There are a number of anchors, probably about 30 or 40 of them in most organizations, that you make those available to every leader at every level. And then they don't need to come back and ask as many questions as they did in the command and control structures that they set aside.
You're absolutely right. And that's, you just anticipated what I was going to say.
Yeah. Okay.
That's why I'm excited about getting to Panish, listening to how we could use AI to disseminate that information. Okay. Go ahead.
So I want to, from a time standpoint, I want to save some time at the end to come back. There's a couple questions, Chuck, about, are you familiar with promise theory?
Promise?
Promise theory?
No.
Okay. Zach, we'll come back to it. What I'd like to do is switch gears and give Phoenicia an opportunity to talk about the tool, the AI tool that he and Nia have been creating, and how this shift in who does design, how we integrate and augment our thinking about design and design choices and options. And then what we'll do is the Q&A with Phoenicia, and then we'll open it up to some of these other questions that are still here, right? So Phoenicia, can I turn it over to you?
Sure, Paul. Thank you. All right. Very nice to be with you here. And I guess I can start by pointing out that my response to the question of what is an adaptive organization is to say it's one where the design is neither permanent nor global. Hmm. Right? Permanent part is easy to understand. We have to keep refining it. But the non-global part is a bit harder to understand. And that's where I think my approach to design comes in. So I have a particular way of thinking about organization design called microstructural analysis. Some of you may have seen the book. The key idea in this book really is that what we take to be large, complex organizations are actually collections of many smaller organizations. And each of them can have quite different designs. So that's what I mean by saying design should not be global. Hmm. Design need be neither permanent nor should it be global. And that's really the research agenda I've been pursuing for more than a decade now. I'll talk very briefly about the core ideas in that approach and how it works and why it works, because it does work, I think. Then we'll switch to using technology to help decentralize design. right? Which is, how do we give the tools for people in different parts of an organization to design their local units with a degree of freedom and autonomy to match the needs of their local context, but still make the overall system globally coordinated? I think that's what we need concretely to do to be able to move this agenda of adaptive organizations forward. And I think this is a really important project for us to pursue collectively, because the alternative is quite scary, right? So what's the alternative? Some of you might have seen the article in The Economist in 2015 about digital Taylorism. And it made a lot of noise. Basically, the article said that Amazon and companies like Amazon were using algorithms to essentially do what managers did, which is control, direct, monitor, reward, and measure more fine-grained. And the consequences of this was that organizations were becoming quite dehumanized, and this trend would continue. And I think it has actually continued to some extent. But the point I wanted to make today is to say that's not the only path, right, that's available to us for using algorithms and AI. There is an alternative path where we use these technologies to enable rather than coerce. Right? And the enabling works if the technologies help humans, not solve it for them, but help humans solve organizational design problems in a way that makes more sense for them. So that's very much the high-level ambition that I've had in my work to try and use digital technologies, particularly AI, to enable humans to solve their own problems better than they could on their own, but without taking away the agency or the skills that they, I think, need to have in order to retain their humanity. So that's, broadly speaking, where I'm coming from. So what's the broad set of ideas that I'm playing with here? I come from the perspective that how to organize ourselves is probably our most important general purpose technology as a species. Everything else we do, whether it's innovating or coming up with new products or new technologies or new social institutions, it rests on this. So if we really think about it, this is what we do really well as a species. It's also among our least understood as a technology. Why do I say that? All you need to do is look at the failure rates for any instances of novel organizing, whether it's startup, post-merger integration, reorganizations, organizational change. The average success rate in these things is about 50%, right? So it's like flipping a coin attached to a very expensive bet. So we don't know enough about this, I think, compared to what we should, given how important it is as a technology. Why is that? It's not because, you know, not enough smart people have been thinking about it. Many people have been trying for a long time. The problem is it's just very complex. Okay? There's just so much interaction. So many parts are interacting with each other. There's so much dynamism in the environment. We got some flavor of that in the conversation with Chuck earlier. I think there's more hope now than there ever was for three reasons. One, I think we have some new theoretical ideas, some of which are mine, but not only mine. We have some access to new data, which is frankly even more important than the theory. And we have algorithms which allow us to crunch that data and link it back to the theory. So this combination of three things which happened now in the last decade or so, I think puts us as a field very close to being at a much better point than we've ever been as a field to be able to do something that's both scientific and practical. Okay, so this is exactly the broad framework that I want to bring here. My approach to org design, which is captured in this book, really rests on three basic ideas. The first is what we call generality. We think of organizations, much as Chuck said, as basically any group with a goal. So that means a department is an organization, so is a team, so is a division, so is an entire company, but so is a strategic alliance of two companies or an ecosystem of 10 companies. So each of these represents groups with a goal. And we think the power of thinking about it in this general way is the second point, which is all these organizations face the same basic universal problems. What are these universal problems? At a very high level, it's simply division of labor and integration of effort. So division of labor, we can break down further into how do you chunk down the goals of the system into tasks, this task division. How do you allocate them, this task allocation. How do you motivate people? How do you coordinate them? And how do you resolve exceptions? So these five problems we think are universal. The problems are universal, the solutions are not, right? And I think a classic example we've used to make this point is compare the Encyclopedia Britannica with Wikipedia. So both are organizations that curate and put together knowledge that is in the world, organized together. But the way they solve these five problems is completely different. So the Encyclopedia Britannica operates on a much more hierarchical basis. Wikipedia operates on much more of a bottom-up approach. even Wikipedia is not free of hierarchy, just to be clear. There is a strong founder effect here in the system, and there are administrators who manage subcomponents of Wikipedia. So Wikipedia is not a totally flat system, but certainly it's far less hierarchical than the Encyclopedia Britannica, and that has its pros and cons. But the point I'm trying to make here is, even though they're both solving the same universal five problems, the solutions could be quite different. And that's what we mean by design. So an organizational design is just the particular set of solutions to a particular organization's universal problems. That's how we think about org design. Now, the solutions come in different flavors. I think that's the third big idea in the book, that if we restrict our thinking to structure, we're really missing two very important tricks, right? Structure, which is mandated patterns of interaction, are a very big class of solutions to org design, and they still will remain important, I think. But increasingly, particularly given the kinds of data we have on networks, on people, on culture, on text, we have to think harder about the other two levers of design, which is sorting. How do you bring in the right set of skills? How do you exit the people who don't fit? Both aspects are important. How do you allow for people to form norms, to cooperate and work informally with each other? This is also partly driven through sorting, right? How do you bring people in? So earlier on, the question was, how do we integrate without a hierarchy? And I would actually flip the question around and say, what do you need a hierarchy for? And I think the answer is because we don't scale consensus very well. If humans were good at scaling consensus infinitely, we would not need authority and we would not need hierarchies of authority, but we're not good at that. So therefore, the solution might be, if you want to avoid hierarchy as a design principle, you either keep groups small or simple or similar. It's an OR function, right? Not an AND function. So either small or simple or similar. If it's small, simple or similar, then you don't really need structures of authority. But as you get large, complex and different, you need authority. So we can use technology to tweak these parameters, how small, how simple, how similar. And that's what we're really thinking about in the design space here. So that's our broad set of design principles here. Just to make it very visual, if you think of a traditional organizational design hierarchy like this, right? This is an organization. But the approach in microstructural analysis says, no, this is not one organization. This is actually a collection of many micro-organizations. This is one, this is another, that's another, so is this, right? So each of these is a group with a goal. And the power of thinking this way, we think, is when you think about the problem like this, it becomes clear that if it's a design problem you're trying to solve with any one of these micro-organizations, the levers you can pull have to do with solving the same five universal problems. There are many solutions, but there are only five problems. And that's why I think the design space becomes manageable. It's still enormously complex, there's no doubt about that. But we know that we can funnel that down into thinking in terms of these five universal problems. And one of the powerful things about design is that we can take ideas from one context and apply them in another, at least as a working hypothesis. It may turn out it doesn't work, we have to discard it then. But design is like that, right? People essentially reuse ideas from one problem to another. And the potential for reuse becomes much higher if you have a common framework within which reuse can be even considered, right? That's the common framework that this approach seems to provide. So I want to leave this part of the discussion with a little celebrity endorsement from somebody no less than President Obama, because he makes the point, I think, much more eloquently than I can, why it's so important to think in terms of universal principles of human dynamics. So here's what he says.
Here's the interesting thing that happens when you're president. Or when you go through the experience of being president. So you start off, you know, you're a community organizer and you're struggling to try to get people to recognize each other's common interests, and you know, you're trying to get some project done in a small community, and you start thinking, okay, you know what, this alderman's a knucklehead and you know, they're resistant to doing the right thing, and so I need to get more knowledge, more power, more influence so that I can really have an impact. And so you go to the state legislature and you look around and you say, well, these jamokes, I mean, the not all of them, but I'm just saying, you know, you start getting that sense of, this is just like dealing with the alderman, right? So, no, I got to do something different. So then you go to the U.S. Senate, and you're looking around, and you're like, oh, man. And then you And then when you're president, you're sitting in these international meetings, and it's like the G20, and you got all these world leaders, and it's the same people. Which is really interesting. Same dynamics. You know, it's just that there's a bigger spotlight, there's a bigger stage. But I'm only partly joking about that. The nature of human dynamics does not change from level to level.
So that's really the core point, I think, which ties together the approach to org design that I work on, which is to say that even complex systems, complex organizations can be broken down into multiple smaller microorganizations. And within each of those, the basic patterns of dynamics don't vary. So there is a universal set of problems. Set of solutions vary a lot, but the problems don't. And if we can lift and drop ideas from one context to the other, try them out, see what's going on, if it's working, it's not working, we have like an enormous palette of ideas to play with, right? This is really what all creative thinking, including design thinking, is all about, right? It's a very big part of what we do as organizational designers, is experiment. And the experimentation comes from ideas we have seen in other contexts. What we're trying to do is give you a formal framework for thinking about what transfers, what does not, and where might you apply some things and where you might not. So this is the background to how we approach problems of org design, which I felt I had to give you, because without this little background, the output that our algorithms generate will not make a lot of sense to you, because their answers are framed in this language, right? They're not framed, for instance, in the language of the Galbraith star model or the McKinsey 7S. And the reason for that, as I've said, is those frameworks focus on solutions, which are not universal, whereas we focus on problems, which are universal. Okay, so I think there is the reason why we do this way, I think, should only justify itself by being successful. So I don't want to pitch it too much here. But it's a different way. And I think you need to be at least familiar with our vocabulary to then make some sense out of what comes up out of our machines. Now, so let's turn to how would we apply these ideas to build algorithmic technologies that enable us to design systems, rather than design them for us, right? That's really the key question. So here's a question for you. What's the difference between an expert organizational designer versus a novice? What happens when somebody becomes an expert? What's changing? Anyone, you can just put it in chat if you like, or you can put it in, or you can unmute yourself and speak. Yep. Go for it, Paul. No. You have more information, more tools, resources.
Looks like we have one person with their hand up there.
Pritjof, go ahead.
I think one thing is that because they've seen more problematic situations and they've seen also more solutions, they understand, they can draw more on their experience, but they're also probably more likely to be hesitant to have easy answers. Because they're now, okay, once we try to implement, it's going to be more tricky.
Yeah.
So they will spend more time looking, okay, what actually is the problem here, instead of going right away to solutions.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Zach?
Yeah, I was going to follow up exactly that. My answer would be just what was said. The ability to understand a context and be able to work with it, to have I don't want to say a more intelligent, but a more nuanced response mm-hmm. or approach to a context, necessarily needing this practice all the time, and maybe able to respond and adapt on the fly
yep.
to somebody's mm-hmm. need in context.
Yeah, very good. So I completely agree with that. So I would frame it in my language as there are at least these three components to what makes expert organization designers expert. First is simply the volume of experience. They've just seen a lot more, right? So there's this old saying from Herb Simon saying, experts learn by doing and doing and doing and doing. So learning by doing is basically at the core of it. So they do a lot and they learn a lot from that. Second, they generalize from what they've learned. So whether we put it down as a formal framework, as Jay Galbraith did, or as Chuck did, or as I'm trying to do in my book, or we don't, we do carry around in our heads certain implicit theories, which come from the generalizations from the experience we have seen. And these become crisper, they become more sophisticated. They see the kind of the contingencies as well as the dangers of over-application. You get better at knowing the limits of your own generalization. Right? These are things that happen with experience as well. And the third, which is much more mundane, but I have to say it, experts also become more disciplined in watching out for the flaws in their own thinking. This is really important to bear in mind because I think the AI tools we're building can really do all three. And sometimes the third, which is a very mundane thing, it's almost the equivalent of saying, make a checklist, right? So you don't forget stuff and you make sure to think about everything. That's pretty powerful too, okay? So there are two ways in which I think systematically human designers often make mistakes. One, when they're looking for new ideas, they tend to fall in love with the first one. So they don't look very far beyond the proximity of where they first landed in the space of design. So it becomes harder to really unfreeze yourself and think about something very different. The second is they tend to converge very rapidly on what others in the group are thinking, groupthink, right? Groupthink is not necessarily always a bug. It could be a feature because often what you want is under enormous time pressure, you want convergence. So that's probably the reason why we have groupthink as a mental module. But when you are not in a situation of time pressure and you want to think carefully through problems, groupthink is a bug. So what AI can already do is act as an actor within a group of humans who is neither prone to fixating on the first good idea, nor is prone to social conformity. So simply having one more voice in the discussion, which might be a devil's advocate or might say something different from you, I think is already enormously valuable, independent of the quality of that voice. Okay, so this is the point I'm trying to make. You don't need these AI algorithms to be smarter than us to be useful. Even if they're just as smart as us, or even maybe a little bit less, maybe they think of them more like a rookie who's not yet an expert, who's being trained to be a designer, hasn't yet figured it out. Their voice is unique in the sense that they don't fall victim to some of these problems of premature fixation or premature convergence. Okay, that's what we're trying to do with these algorithms, which is to synthesize the experience base that we have collected over our lives. Take our theories. Theories are just summaries of experience, right? That's one way to describe a theory. A theory is a crisp summary of an experience base or a data set. And then add on to that these kind of checks and balances to make sure that we're not missing out on hitting the important points, that we're considering the alternatives, that we're considering the trade-offs. So that's our approach to developing these systems. Now, technically, what we've done is we've taken large language models, like the ChatGPT or GPT 3.5 or 4, or you could do it with Bard or with Claude. And that's like a base layer of the technology on which we add something called a knowledge layer. So the knowledge layer is what we have designed based on our understanding of the research and the theories that we have. And the power of the technology is these two get integrated. Okay. And when they get integrated, the results they can bring us can be very powerful. I'll show you what it looks like in a second. There are two ways in which one can integrate this, and I'll show you both as well. But to truly appreciate the power of such a system, I'd like to first show you a design problem and get you to think about it for 5 minutes. I decided we'll skip the breakout rooms. We don't need breakout rooms. We can just do it here, right? So I'm just going to put up this problem here for all of us to just look at for a couple of minutes and try to figure out what's going on, okay? How would we go about approaching solving this problem? Here's the problem statement. I think this is a problem statement many of us are probably looking at in some form right now from our clients, right? So the problem statement is we need to build a new generative AI applications development unit reporting directly to the top management of a multi-business company. So think of Procter & Gamble or FM or another FMCG like Unilever, if you like. So this company has a large variety of units which cater to different stakeholders and geographies, with the units acting fairly autonomously. Okay? So it's like a divisionalized structure. The groups that you are going to design, the group, will have about 50 to 60 employees, and you can hire from the market to build this organization. You probably have to because skills don't exist in those. The key constraint here, number one, is it must be up and running in 6 months. Okay? Success is going to be defined by the number of developed AI applications that various businesses find useful. The second design constraint is you have to allow for flexible remote working. That's at least for two reasons. One, most of the talent is very hard to find in one location. Second, most people in this space today take for granted that you allow them some flexibility on working remotely. So you've got to take this into account. So how would we design an organizational unit which meets these requirements? So I'm going to let you think about this for 5 minutes. Maybe you can think collectively. You can brainstorm, put it in chat as you're thinking, right? So it can be a silent but extremely chatty discussion all on the chat room here. And in the meantime, we will set up our machines and show you what they can produce.
Yeah. Are you just going to put people into random groups?
No, I think we'll skip the groups, Paul. I don't think we have enough time because we're a bit behind schedule.
So we just want to open. Go. Okay.
Yeah, we just do it here in the group here. We just have a collective discussion on chat for 5 minutes. What I can also do is post a copy of this text in the chat so you have access to it when I take it off screen.
Perfect.
For clarification for me on the exercise, though, when it says the success is the number of AI applications that various businesses find useful, meaning the divisions, the parts internally?
That's right.
Okay, okay.
The parts internally.
And then as you have thoughts and ideas, as Shiba just did, just put your thoughts and comments in the chat box.
Yeah. What we're also doing in these 5 minutes is kind of simulating how a DAO would work, like a decentralized autonomous organization, because they do all their governance discussions on chat forums like this. So Paul, if we leave 15 minutes in the end for open Q&A, is that okay?
Perfect. I think there's one open question that's left over. And then if we, you know, if people have questions for you, we can do that. Yeah. That'd be perfect.
All right, so we're 2.5 of our 5 minutes down.
Yep.
Your comments?
Okay, I think we are up with the 5 minutes, so.
There we go. Put your comments in.
Okay, excellent, thank you. So let me share my screen here and you'll see what I'm doing here. So what you see here is the interface to the technology we have put together, which is called the Eunomicon. So Eunomicon is named after Eunomia, the Greek goddess of governance and good order. And what Eunomicon basically is it's a large language model that starts with a generically available model like ChatGPT 3.5 or 4, but then adds a knowledge layer. And it's the integration of that knowledge layer along with the underlying GPT that allows the system to be so powerful. Now, there are a couple of different ways we can do it. One way is for the GPT and our knowledge layer to be fully integrated, which is what is happening here, which takes a bit of time because what it's doing is it's reading our knowledge layer, integrating it with everything that GPT knows from learning from everything on the web. And the combination is what you will see. You can also do a more limited version of this, which is what we do for students. So this is another AI bot we've developed called Lila. Lila stands for Language Model AI Learning Assistant. And Lila has been trained on the content of my classes and courses to help my students as a tutor. So we can ask Lila the same question, and Lila is much faster, as you see. So Lila is already thinking and there you go. So it's putting together an answer based on reporting structure, team size, recruitment process, performance metrics, knowledge sharing, training programs, incentive program. So not that much better than a basic checklist, I would say at this point. That's Lila because it's not really leveraging the full power of what you get when you combine the GPT with this. But it's already a good step forward, right? Because what you can do is query it on more details. You can say, tell me more about the incentive system. What should I use? And these systems are pretty forgiving of spelling mistakes, right? So you can type in a fairly sloppy manner, as I usually do. And it comes back as a response. It says, this is a greenfield project, so it understood it's a greenfield project. So the bias should be towards material rewards to attract top talent globally. However, it's also important to consider intangible components like recognition and rewards and so on. So it can give you a reasoned answer as to why it's suggesting what it's doing. You can also use it in the opposite direction, which is you can propose a design and have these systems critique them. So you can say, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And it'll give you a point of view based on what it's doing. Can you see Unomic on screen now? Yeah, so this is now, you can see it's solving the problem in real time. So the text is coming out. And you'll see why I spent the time going over our approach, because it gives you the answers based on those terms. So what's the task division, task allocation, reward distribution, information provision, exception handling, org structure, and so on. And Unomicon is careful to say, please note this is a high-level outline and further details would be required for a comprehensive org design. It is recommended to involve key stakeholders and employees in the design process to ensure alignment with the specific needs and goals of the unit. So I want to stress that what you're seeing coming out here is a design proposal. It's not a design. Okay, it's a proposal for a design. And it can give you multiple ones. You can say, give me a different proposal in which the teams are organized as agile units. Again, my spelling is terrible, but fortunately, Unomicon is very forgiving. Okay, so I can say, give me a different proposal in which teams are organized as agile units, and it'll crunch through that. Let's ask Lila what it thinks. How about a design in which the teams are agile units? Okay, so notice what I'm also doing here is capitalizing on the diversity of these two models. It's like having two different points of view available to me. Okay, so quite often nowadays, I will in my class have a committee of three AIs. So I'll have GPT, Bard, and also Claude 2, which comes from Anthropic. And I take students' answers and run them through all three. And the three of them will vote, right? So because an odd number, you will always get a vote one way or the other, thumbs up or thumbs down. And essentially, it's not that I'm trying to reify these machines to replace me. I'm treating them as another point of view, which I have ready access to without having to, sweat it. That's the power of it. So you really can get another point of view, another voice into the discussion, which would otherwise be quite hard. So hopefully you get some sense of how these systems are working. They're building on basic underlying GPT models, on top of which we're putting our knowledge layer. A lot of thought obviously has to go into designing that knowledge layer. Where does that come from? It comes from a combination of our experience and our theory, right? As professional academics, we spend a lot of time on that conversion from experience to theory, whereas maybe not everybody would, but I bet all of you also are theorists, even in the world of practice, because you become one by dint of having a lot of experience. So once we have that, we're able to embed it in these systems and build it in such a way that when you ask a question, you're getting the benefit of the integration between the knowledge layer and the underlying GPT. Okay? So that's broadly what I wanted to show you. I think these are very powerful technologies. They can act as a co-pilot. I really want to emphasize co-pilot because it's not an oracle. I don't think it would be a good idea to rely on these designs as the final product, right? Not necessarily because they are wrong. They may not even be wrong. But more importantly, we will then lose our sense of control and our ability to come up with designs ourselves if we rely extensively on them. So I wouldn't use them as an oracle. I would not use them as an assistant either, right? Which means you offload things you're bored with to an assistant so you can do creative stuff. That's a bad idea too. Because anything you offload to an assistant, you lose the skill over time. Okay, this has been true for navigation. It's been true for some kinds of mathematics as well among the general public, not professional mathematicians, of course. So with things that have a use it or lose it feature, relying on these systems either as an oracle or an assistant is a bad idea. But it's fine to use it as a co-pilot. So what's a co-pilot? A co-pilot is like a colleague. And what's the distinctive feature of a colleague? A colleague is somebody you can choose to ignore. Right? So colleagues can tell you their suggestions and you may pay attention to them or you may not. But the point is they are like an independent point of view, a voice that is free of these problems of being fixated on one good idea or being subject to social pressure, but they may have very different ways of thinking, and that diversity is useful to you. So I would use these, if you like, that's my summary, as a form of creating diversity of inputs in the ideation process, but not as a final solution of any kind. Let me stop there and see if I can take questions specific to me, or maybe Chuck and I can take some questions together. I will also give you access to Unomicon if you want it, and Lila. If you write to us and let us know, we'll give you a week's access so you can play with it. Please do bear in mind one very important thing. Unomicon is integrated fully in the backend to GPT, to OpenAI, which means anything you put in there will also be seen by OpenAI. So please be very careful not to put in anything that identifies you or your client or anything sensitive, right? Lila is fully bounded in our system, so it will not transfer any information out of our control. So you can be a bit more relaxed about what you ask Lila. But, you know, clearly Unomicon is the more powerful machine. Let me stop there.
So we have roughly 15 minutes left. I mean, why don't, maybe as opposed to putting questions in the chat box, maybe if you would just raise your hand if you have a question for Phanish. Let's take a few questions for Phanish, and then there is this one topic that caught a lot of energy in Chuck in your session, part of the session. So questions for Phanish about the tool, the application, the underlying theory, anything, please. Could you just, Fishop, why don't we start with you, and then yep. Harris, if we go with you, okay? Go.
Yeah, I'm wondering, so if I understand correctly, one of the key limitations of AI and algorithms is that as time progresses, the performance deteriorates, and it deteriorates because the data that the AI has been building on is outdated. There is a new situation, changing situation. So how does this AI update itself, so to say? And I think there was a question in the chat around, okay, how do you integrate the diagnosis in this tool? So how do you make sure that you have all the issues, say like cultural issues that are very difficult to really represent in some kind of way. So how does the AI learn over time?
So firstly, this generalization that AI gets worse over time is not accurate in my view. It is true in very particular narrow situations where the models don't update. But by and large, I think the story of AI developments has been the opposite. They just keep getting better all the time. So the evidence is mostly they do get better. How do they get better? They have to be updated. You're absolutely right. So how do you update them? You can refresh the knowledge layer as frequently as you like, okay? But here's the point. If you build a really robust, theoretically based knowledge layer, you would not have to need to update. That's been my approach, because this universal problems framework, my claim is, even if we live in a world 50 years from now where organizations are all robots and all AI, org design will still need to solve those five problems. So I don't need to update anything, in my opinion, in my approach to this. Now, the question about diagnosis, actually, I didn't show you that, but Unomicon can do diagnosis too. So the way we've trained it, you can just say, I have this problem where decisions are really slow and things are piling up with one layer in the hierarchy. What should I do? That's all you need to say. And it will give you a bunch of possible reasons why it's happening, as well as a bunch of possible solutions. So it is a generative tool, right? That's what it does. It generates lots of ideas and things about it. Hopefully that answers your question. Harris?
How about Harris? Why don't we go to you, and then Zach, we'll go to you.
Sounds good. Phanish, thank you for all this. I'm curious, in your practical work with clients, how have you optimally deployed Unomicon with the work that you're doing for clients in org design?
We haven't done it at all, Harris. This is where you guys come in, right? So I'm a professional academic. I spend very little time doing anything other than stare at my screen and write papers. But I think you are my arms and eyes and ears in the world. So I would love for you to take this and try it out with your clients and come back and tell me how we can make it more useful.
Awesome. Zach?
I'm just curious your take on generating these tools and with the intent of making them so, you know, to empower people in their thought. Yet the tendency I observe in the world is that people tend to look for silver bullets and easy solutions and like have people do the thinking for them. What's your thoughts on developing these? And then, you know, what's your forecast for how well they'll be used in the world going forward? And maybe how do we protect it from being used the way that you intend them?
So I'm not really an expert on interface design, right? But I have some hunches about how we can make this work. What's very clear to me is if you fall into the model of relying on them as oracles or assistants, we are in trouble. So we have to keep people in this co-pilot mode. Now, how do we achieve that? One way is to actually give these things a slightly edgy personality. So it almost invokes in you the desire to disagree with them, which is the point, right? The whole point of this is to create something that forces you to think in a way you won't on your own. So I might almost embody them with a personality that's slightly annoying. So, I don't know. This is one hunch. I'm not saying this is the only way to do it. So this is something that people far more expert than me in interface design have to come up with ideas. We'll A-B test them and figure it out. But you want this to be like that grouchy colleague in your department who everybody knows is a really smart person, but it's kind of annoying. You really don't want to agree with them. You're forced to despite not having to. That's the value, I think, of these things. So I think that might be one approach to designing. The other, by the way, is to build a committee of these. That's what I mentioned earlier. So you could use Enomicon plus Lila plus maybe a third machine, which comes from different knowledge banks, right? And then they duke it out and then they kind of give you a recommendation as a committee and then you decide as a CEO what to do.
Yeah. There's one question in the chat box that says from Bruce, how does the tool connect beyond the verbal input, feelings, emotions, weather, group dynamics, right? The things that are in the air that you can't see.
Yeah. So I should point out this, maybe I should have done it earlier as well. So when Nee and I first started talking about this, I'm not sure I introduced Nee formally. I'm sorry, I didn't actually. So Dr. Nee Truong is my colleague who's helped me develop this. In fact, she's leading the development of it. I produced the theory layer. So Nee is a professor at Sassam Business School in Thailand. And she was at INSEAD for a year as a postdoc after getting her PhD at ASM. So when we first started talking about this, there was this basic divide in what makes a design good. One is it's objectively good in the sense it solves the problem in a particular context. But the other is it's also got to be seen as legitimate. Right? In fact, I would argue that designs can be sort of iffy on the quality dimension, but if they really get buy-in, they will work because people are committed to them. So the ability to get buy-in from people and get them to see legitimately that, yeah, this is a good approach to our problem, we should try it out. This is something only humans can do right now, right? Partly the reason for that is these technologies don't yet have incarnations. So they can do chat. Soon we can put faces on them. We can put voices on them, right? But it won't be the same as sitting down face-to-face across a coffee table with someone and trying to talk through issues and building trust and legitimacy. So that aspect, I think, is very much still a human prerogative. So that's why that combination of human trust building, opinion seeking, getting the sense and smell of what's happening, and then using these to kind of objectively improve the design search for good designs, I think that's what we need to be doing for a while at least.
I think Mike McGovern just put a comment in the chat box that summarizes a little bit of what you've been saying, Phinesh. What Mike said is, as a part of implementation, you can use an AI tool, but still test the solutions in the real world as part of the implementation shakeout strategy, right? Which I think is the heart of how you, at least as you and I've talked, how you imagine when you use the term copilot, that's
exactly it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Any last burning questions from anybody? If you would, Ray. Oh, Jim, go, please.
Actually, just a reinforcement of Phinesh's last statement about using AI to further conversation it's a really interesting practice to give people four or five different AI agents and ask them to pose a question to all of them and then bring it back to the group. It helps those people who really don't understand the topic at all to get into the conversation. And it will bring in a very off the wall idea that enriches the conversation. So I'm thoroughly with you on jump in with AI in terms of just collecting data and aligning people into a conversation.
Yeah. I saw an application recently of this idea, which I thought was really amazing. So this was with Lila, not with Enomicon. Teaching a bunch of senior execs in the Middle East. And they have a culture of not publicly disagreeing with each other in groups. But I noticed one group member doing this very smartly, which was to say, I think your idea is a good one. Why don't we ask Lila what it thinks? Right? So essentially deflecting the burden of being the naysayer onto the machine. And I think that's already such a powerful thing because now you can get another voice into the discussion, which the human may not have felt empowered to raise. So yeah, I think things like that can already create quite a lot of value, independent of the quality of the solution that's coming up.
Yeah, you know, and maybe to circle back, Chuck, in the chat box, my prediction is that chapter 3 will be the most read chapter in your book, the actor-oriented designing, organizing. I think that generated probably the most number of comments early on in the conversation. And the idea of taking the actor-oriented notion of self-design and giving people a tool like Venetia's tool enables people to think more broadly, to actually have inputs beyond what they could imagine, right? To be able to do some of this work in an ongoing emergent kind of way. I think when you put the two together, right? But my prediction is chapter 3 will be the most read chapter in your book, Chuck.
Okay. Want a bear on it or anything?
You know, and I think it's a little bit of how would actor-oriented designing really work? What, you know, the questions around hierarchy, leadership, goals, who sets all those things, all those other things come up as a part of it, right? And all the people parts to it. So Chuck, Vinish, Nihai, thank you guys for doing this for us today. Thanks for partnering to do it together. The stuff in the chat box, as always, Tanya, is absolutely amazing. And if we could capture that and send it off to people, it's hard to listen and to read all that at the same time. There's a lot of rich stuff going on in the sidebars. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining. I hope you had a great time. Be well, safe travels wherever you are. Good morning, good evening, good night. Be well.
Thanks, Paul.
Paul, thanks for leading this and jumping in again. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The chat will be included when I put the recordings and let everybody know that they're on our website and ready for review.
You know, there is an AI companion. Do we actually ask for an AI recording?
I haven't tested and played with it. I've just noticed that it has popped up on my power bar at the bottom, but right. We had somebody's Otter AI tool, Ken. Say that AI he had his doing it. So he is, I think at the beginning of the chat, he might've shared what's going to come out from it and then people can contribute to it after the fact. So
it would be awesome to have that as well. Super. All right,
everyone. Thank you so much. Have a great day. I'll stay on the line for a moment or two if anybody has questions. And then we do have a reminder. Tomorrow is our submission deadline for our 2024 peer presentations for our concurrent sessions during the conference next May. And we've got a couple people here that have submitted proposals, a couple people that are on the planning committee, and we'll look forward to seeing what we get in over the weekend.
Super. Right. Thank you. Don't forget you'll be getting to play with the tool, everybody. So
yes, that email will come out shortly once Nihai and I get it all coordinated because it's late for her.
And feedback to the authors. Awesome. Be well, everybody. Take care.
Thank you.